Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's December 13th, 2019 program, Addressing Asset Poverty, From Owing to Owning. This is the 14th program of our 2019-2020 programming year. My name is Eric Richardson, and I serve as the president of the City Club of Eugene. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Today we have both business and in-kind sponsors, including our diamond sponsors, Kaiser Permanente, who exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and to improve the health of our members and the communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. The University of Oregon, since 1876, the UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. And Peace Health. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown healthcare partner for more than 80 years, their mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. So, and finally, don't want to forget our local community college, Lane Community College. They transform lives through learning. It provides a comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, you can visit lanecc.edu/programs. And we'd also like to thank and acknowledge the generous support coming from the City of Eugene. This is something that we've just been able to secure in the last several months, and I think that we want to continue inviting people to join the City Club as we build a cohesive, unified community and well-informed community. So now I'd like to bring up Joshua Purvis, who will tell us about today's program. Josh?
Thank you, Eric. According to new research by Oregon State University, a majority of Americans live in asset poverty, meaning they have few or no assets to rely on in the event of a financial crisis, such as a job loss or a medical emergency. Lacking assets like vehicles, homes, savings accounts, or investments, families are often unable to cope with crises without sacrificing basic needs like food, clothing, and shelter. Additionally, a growing body of research suggests that parents' asset levels also predict their children's educational expectations and academic achievement, including their likelihood of enrolling in and graduating from college. In a political environment that focuses more often on income inequality than on wealth inequality as a key determinant of economic well-being, are we, the American public, ignorant of the real underlying issue that prevents people from achieving the American dream? If policy prescriptions aimed at reducing poverty narrowly frame the issue in terms of income, do our elected leaders underutilize opportunities to ameliorate poverty through asset accumulation that could lead to greater self-sufficiency? Today, we'll hear from David Rothwell, who will define and discuss asset poverty as a key indicator for understanding economic vitality in the U.S. Dr. Rothwell is Associate Professor of Public Health and Human Sciences at Oregon State University. At OSU, he leads the Poverty and Inequality Group, which conducts research on poverty measurement and analysis of social policies that affect poverty. He earned a master's in social work from Tulane University and a PhD in social welfare from the University of Hawaii in Manoa. Following Professor Rothwell's presentation, he will join John Haynes and Sven Gatvich of Mercy Corps in a panel discussion. Both Mr. Haynes and Mr. Gatchev administer Mercy Corps' Community Investment Trust Initiative, which provides a low-barrier investment opportunity for working-class Americans to invest in commercial real estate. Before transitioning to the role of Community Investment Trust Executive Director for Mercy Corps' Global Innovations Team, Mr. Haynes joined the reputable humanitarian aid nonprofit as executive director of their local economic development affiliate, Mercy Corps Northwest. Also representing Mercy Corps is Mr. Gatchev, who serves as operations manager for the Community Investment Trust. He is a graduate of our very own Lundquist College of Business at the University of Oregon, where he received his master's in business administration. So on behalf of City Club and the City of Eugene, I welcome these distinguished gentlemen to speak today on the issue of asset poverty. I'll now turn it over to Professor Rothwell to give his presentation. Professor Rothwell.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the introduction, Joshua. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, the City Club of Eugene, for inviting me and importantly, choosing to talk about this topic of asset poverty today. The subject of asset poverty falls within a broader theme of social and economic inequality, and I want to frame the talk today around that theme as much about poverty and asset poverty. Before jumping into what I want to accomplish today, I want to acknowledge that any concern for poverty, whether that's assets, income, or otherwise, is part of this broader concern for inequality of both opportunity and inequality in outcomes. It is widely recognized that in many areas of social and economic life, some today are benefiting while others are not, and it's incumbent upon us who care about civic engagement to be informed of what's going on. Debates about whether or not these patterns are just or good for society are inherently political. They are ongoing, and to get into all of this is well beyond the ability. I can't accomplish all of this in this short talk. But I will focus on three things. So Joshua has asked me to talk about why assets matter. What are some of the theoretical and conceptual background for why wealth and assets matter? I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the empirical research, the science behind it, and then towards the end I'm going to frame some discussion around what I think is going on in Oregon. You know, at the end, I hope you'll have a better understanding for why wealth and assets matter and what we need to do about asset poverty. I believe that to develop good policy and interventions, we need to establish some basic facts about the problem and of concern to understand how we can address them. In the Q&A discussion, I hope we get into the policies, but I'm not going to stand here and tell us which policies we should pursue. So the distribution of wealth and assets is a huge topic, and I'm going to really focus on the bottom 50% of the wealth distribution. I'm going to mostly focus my interest on families, children and families, and I'm going to present some descriptive research. As I said, I'm not going to prescribe policies to address these problems. And there's a lot of limitations in what I'll present, and one of them is that we don't fully consider all of the causes of asset poverty here. There's major things that are missing. So with that, I'll go ahead and get started here. So within the topic of economic inequality, most of the discussion on that topic is about incomes. When you read the newspaper, the magazine headlines like the one shown on the screen from the Atlantic Monthly, talking about the new American aristocracy, These are mostly about incomes. So there's a real minority of focus on wealth and assets. I did a Google search and just to find out the difference between who searches for income and income inequality and wealth inequality. And as I would expect, the income inequality searches into Google were about three times more frequent than assets or wealth. So there's most of the research is on income inequality, a small amount is on wealth, and of that amount that's on wealth, most of that focuses on the upper end of the distribution, on high wealth individuals. Recent books about how high wealth people hide their wealth and tax evasion and growing wealth of CEOs in the country, that's where most of the press and where a lot of the data has come. My research and my interest is instead on the lower part of the distribution and focusing on what low-income people in the middle and lower classes and their wealth and financial well-being. So that's where I'm going to focus on. To start out, it's important to define the terms of engagement here. What do we mean by assets? Technically, when economists or social sciences think about assets, it means income that is not consumed. You know, there's two major type of resources that we're talking about for family finances, income and assets. And so when we don't consume that income, it turns into an asset. On assets, there are total assets, which are financial assets and non-financial assets. And net worth is total assets minus debts. All of these are important. Most of the work I'll be talking about, and I'll hone in the focus on financial assets. So, and we'll hear later from the folks from Mercy Corps on homes and home ownership and some of the other, I think, more non-financial assets. But we're really talking about liquid forms of wealth and assets. So if you think about your own balance sheets and your own family finances, we're talking about things like checking, savings, things you can access and you can have liquid access to. You can get access to this cash quite quickly. This non-consumed income is important for social welfare, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. So people talk about assets as having a number of qualities that income does not. And I'm really just brushing the surface here. You can read entire volumes on each one of these points, but really people think about income as flows of resources coming in and out, whereas assets are more long-term permanent. People think of them as stocks rather than flows. They're more permanent. Assets have a long-term accumulation. We don't, you know, especially if you think about how wealth is passed on from generation to generation through inheritance and other mechanisms, wealth is much more long-term than income. And compared to income, wealth and assets are invested. We can generate more wealth and more assets from those that exist. And the last point there is that income and wealth are correlated. You might be thinking, you know, most people that have high wealth also have high assets, but the correlation is not as high as many people think. So these are important kind of functions that assets have that we must keep in mind. As an academic, I have to put some theory and some academic theory on here. There's kind of three schools of thought for why assets are important for social welfare. The first one is one that is probably the most common and comes to mind, is that assets serve as an insurance mechanism to smooth shocks of consumption. That's what economists talk about. So when you have an unexpected event in your life, you draw down your assets or your savings to get by. That's a very important mechanism, but it's not the only one. The other things that are important, and there's others that aren't here, but these are, in my view, the most important, is stratification. So wealth and assets function to divide society into groups that have power and other groups that have less power. And we see these divisions in society. And if we think about assets and wealth as an indicator of this stratification, it gives us insight into social and economic inequality. The last one is that the theory and the idea goes that asset holding will promote individual and social development in ways that income cannot. And so the easiest way to think about it is if you have assets, if you're owning wealth, you may think about the future in a way different than if you had very low assets and low wealth. You're thinking about how to do things for yourself, your family, your community in ways that are different from income. Okay, consumption, stratification, and development. Real briefly, I could go on for a long time on this too, but there is a growing amount of evidence that has empirically found a distinct relationship between assets and a variety of outcomes that is different from income. you know, these are some of the things. The most important idea is that assets promote a sense of financial security and this sense of long-term well-being. For example, I mentioned assets have been shown to change the way people think about the future. Assets also help families locate into healthy and safe environments. They help people be more selective in the labor market and so on. We've done some research showing that when people have assets and they use them for that consumption method to smooth unexpected events and reduce family stress. All of these have downstream effects on family well-being. So that's the first part. Now I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how we measure asset poverty and what we know about asset poverty in our country. So the famous management strategist Peter Drucker said, if you can't measure it, you can't improve it. I think many people are interested in reducing economic inequality, reducing asset poverty, and so therefore we need to measure it. The Nobel laureate economist Angus Deaton talked about how measurement, even without an understanding of the mechanisms, can be of great importance in and of itself. Policy change is frequently based on it. So there are good reasons to focus on measurement. Here's our paper. The idea is that if we operate under the assumption that assets matter, as I just told you previously, that assets are different from income, it begs the question, at what level are assets low, or what level are they high, at what level might they affect people? And then, of course, once we draw that level, then we want to know how big of a problem is this and how many people are affected by it. So when we talk about asset poverty, we just go back to thinking about poverty measurement in general. And any poverty measure has three components. We have resources, we have some threshold, and we have the time, which is usually a year. So there's a lot of ink spilled and arguments had over how to count these resources and how to define the thresholds. I'll start with some examples. So the U.S. poverty line that you read about in the newspaper, you know, as an informed citizenry, you would see every September that the poverty rate in the country or in the state of Oregon has gone up or down based on the U.S. official poverty measure. And this measure, for those three components, it includes pre-tax cash income. The threshold of need is defined as, it was based in 1963, and it was defined as the cost of food times three, and that was the poverty line. So if you can think about, well, there's a lot to say about that threshold, but if you can think about what an average family spends on food and then times that by three, that was the basis of the poverty line. Well, the price of food and how families spend their money has changed a lot since 1963, but we still use this threshold today to define poverty. So for a family of two adults and one child, a family of three, you know, you take those resources and you divide them by the threshold and you get a ratio that determines whether you're poor or not. So in an example family that has $15,000 of household income, if the poverty threshold was $17,000, the $15,000 is below the $17,000 and therefore they're poor. That's how it works, and then we count how many families, how many individuals, how many children in a given location fall below that threshold. That's how it works. Well, it turns out we can extend the same logic, the same framework for measuring poverty to think about asset poverty. We just exchange instead of counting income in the resources, we count the assets. And then we take the threshold of the income poverty line and we say, well, it's reasonable to assume that you could be able to survive at the poverty line for 3 months if you lost your job. This can be debated. This is not the only way to do it, but if you take the poverty line and divide it into a 3-month interval, then we think that is the most standard asset poverty threshold. So what does that mean for for measurement. You can think of the family size adjusted threshold around $5,000. Goes up or down depending on the family size. But, you know, when we do all of those adjustments with the data, this is how we count asset poverty. So, for example, a family that only has $3,000 of liquid assets, they would be below the $5,000 threshold, and so therefore that family would be counted as asset poor. Then we take the best household survey data available and kind of count how many people fall above or below the threshold. I hope that makes sense. It's kind of simplifying some things, but those are the technical details of it. So we've done some work asking this question of asset poverty, mostly among children across countries. And some of our findings show that the U.S. has a pretty high rate of child asset poverty. In fact, 2 out of 3 children in the U.S. fall below this threshold of asset poverty. 2 out of 3. That's a lot. When we look at other countries, such as, you know, Italy is around 45%, and then in a place like Norway, it's 1 in 3 children are living in a household with low assets. So we see really wide cross-national variation on this. Also important to point out that asset poverty is 2 to 3 times higher than income poverty. So we know they're correlated, but they're not the same thing, and our research shows that. When we compare countries and we control statistically for family structure, education, labor market attachment, things like this, we still find that children in the U.S. have a higher risk of being born into or being raised in a family who is asset poor than all the countries with available data. So this is fascinating in itself, and trying to understand. We have a whole program of research trying to understand these patterns. Now, you may be wondering what causes asset poverty. Who are those that are more likely to be asset poor? I'm sure you have some ideas in your head of who these types of families might be. All the usual suspects are there. Single parent families have really high asset poverty, like 82%. But this alone doesn't explain this cross-national difference. Things like family structure, education, age, and employment status are all related, but the most important thing that distinguishes the U.S. compared to other countries is how education matters. So if you have low education, your risk for asset poverty in the U.S. is much higher than a similarly low-educated person in another country. So this gives us an insight into what's going on in the U.S. and our society to cause this relationship. We don't have the answer, but we're working on it. Okay, so that's a little tidbit on the science of asset poverty. Now I want to talk about, shift our focus here back home to Oregon. There is research on asset poverty for many of the states, and the most similar indicator that we have, you would see here that Oregon falls kind of in the upper 25% of states. They have one of the lower asset poverty rates, Oregon does. You see the national rate is around 44%, 45% of all people. The work I was showing was children. So this is all people, liquid asset poverty. I just wanna, the group that does this work, Prosperity Now, is doing excellent work to talk about wealth and assets and make policy recommendations. But as a research scientist, I wanna just caution these data. They come from pretty small sample sizes with large margins of error, and it's kind of difficult to say with certainty that this is the exact asset poverty level. It's helpful, but I think there's a lot more to be said about the numbers. So that's where I start. And then I think this is one of my last things I want to talk about are what Thomas Piketty, who wrote a really really fascinating book on the history of capital. I talk about a big subject. And he talked about he talked about worrisome forces of divergence and convergence. The story of inequality and asset poverty is not one that's all negative or certainly not all positive, but we need to think about the social forces that are working here. So I thought about what's going on in Oregon and talked about divergence and convergence here. So in Oregon, we know that the growth in the economy is happening a lot for low wage and unstable jobs. We also know that we have high childcare costs in the state that place a considerable economic burden on our families. And we have inequalities that are rooted very early in the education system that we need to address. Okay, so those are the worrying trends of divergence. On convergence, on things that might be reducing inequality, we have to recognize that we've seen a decade of strong economic growth in the state that is lifting many families' living standards. We've seen progressive policies on minimum wages, investments in early childhood and education this past session, and important policies that put Oregon on the map, things like the Oregon Saves program, state earned income tax credit, and the recently passed parental leave policy. I think we'll get into these more in the Q&A. So to close, I just want to reiterate four points that you might have picked up on along my talk, but the first one is that there are theoretical and important reasons to measure assets and asset poverty in addition to income. And these are not just a consumption story. It's not just about getting through the unexpected expense, but there's good evidence to suggest that wealth has other, that wealth affects family well-being in other ways. The second point is that when we do measure asset poverty, it's the level of asset poverty is high. It's, you know, the first time I saw the numbers and thinking about 2 out of 3 children living in a family with low assets, that struck me as high. And, you know, many families are on the financial edge, so to speak. The third point is that children are at a unique risk for asset poverty, and children growing up today in these conditions are going to, you know, this has implications for the future. You know, we're studying inequality today, but for the children that are growing up in these conditions, you know, I have concerns about where this is going to lead our society in the future. And last, you know, as a good academic, I have to acknowledge the limitations here. We're kind of in the early stages of this topic. People have only been studying asset poverty for 15 years or so, and so we need a lot better theories to understand what explains these. A lot of the problem has been a limited data access, and so there's really only so much we can do, but there we have it. I want to thank you for your time today and look forward to the rest of the program.
All right, thank you, David. That was very informative information. And so now we're going to take a break so that you all can formulate your questions, and then we will be right back for the question and answer session. Thank you.
Good evening. You're listening to City Club of Eugene on KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. You can find all City Club of Eugene programs on our website, klcc.org.
Welcome back to the December 13, 2019 program, Addressing Asset Poverty from Owing to Owning. I'd like to turn today's program over to Josh, our program coordinator, who will take it from here. Josh.
Thank you, Eric. Josh Purvis, City Club member and program coordinator. This question is for John and Sven of Mercy Corps. And the question is, how is Mercy Corps' Community Investment Trust a response to asset poverty in the Pacific Northwest, and how has it been designed for replication by other organizations in other communities?
Okay, I'm John Haynes with Mercy Corps, the Community Investment Trust in Portland. First of all, it's great to be in Eugene. This is where I started my career as a banker, as a management trainee 30 years ago, right down the street at what was then First Interstate, now Wells. Anyway, the Community Investment Trust, Sven and I are going to tag team a quick presentation on what it is. So we're going to talk about the people. It starts with the people. It ends with the people. We're going to talk about the product, the purpose, and the prospects and our goal of reaching 1 million people nationwide in 5 years. The Community Investment Trust is a financial product aimed at the poor. We started by calling it renter equity, so giving an affirmative upward path for renters to gain access to an investment path they otherwise are excluded from. And we changed the name to Community Investment Trust really to capture a wider motivation of all people in a neighborhood. But our target is first-time investors, low-income people that otherwise don't have access to an investment path. It's an investment in a commercial real estate building. We'll talk about the billing when Sven jumps on. Here's the five differences. It's the first one in the nation. It's in Portland, out on in East Portland, 122nd Market. And the investment product is for people to be able to buy the building. It's not them purchasing the building. We purchased the building, and we shifted it into a corporation, and they buy it as shareholders over the course of time at $10, $25, $50, or $100 a month, fitting into people's budget. It's downside risk protected through a letter of credit with a bank, so investors can get their money out anytime they want with a guaranteed no loss provision. We offer a class called Moving from Owing to Owning and Budgeting, Goal Setting, the risk and return of a range of investments, and then we present this at the end. Sven, you want to jump in on the property?
Sven Gatchi from Mercy Corps and Community Investment Trust. To tell you a little bit about the property, about the place, so as we mentioned, this is East Portland. East Portland is the area of town where about 30% of the people live, but actually 60% of the youth, the children in the city live. And it's also the census tract is some of the most racially and culturally diverse in the state of Oregon. We're in the school next door to us, there's over 40 languages spoken as a first language at home. So we went there. The property, it's a commercial property, about 27 for-profit and nonprofit tenants rent from it. It's a naturally occurring, affordable space that really a great variety of tenants rent there. So we have a Somali-owned taxi cab company, a Latina-owned hair salon, a number of nonprofits from Ethiopian Eritrean Community Center to the Somali Association of Oregon to tax preparers in four or five different languages, from to affordable, to a Russian-owned hair salon, for instance. So that's the property, and the community owns it. And from place, this is place to people, and who are the people that currently own the property? So as we mentioned, we transferred ownership to the community about 2 years ago, 26 months ago, actually, to be exact. And we currently have about 150 investors. There's room for about 400 investors to buy out all the available equity in the property over the next 3 to 4 years. And who are the people that currently are investing, those 150 investors? They've all gone through the classes. We've taught it in 9 different languages. We have about 70% of the people have never invested before. About 60% are renters. Nearly 60% of community of color. About 60% are from households that make under $40,000 a year. So we're already seeing that the people are exactly the people that we're hoping to see.
Let me talk about prospects for us. We needed to do a proof of concept. This was the first time anybody had done anything like this in the nation. We incubated this about 8 years ago. We felt the motivation of the people. We started with a human-centered design, talking with people in affordable housing out in East Portland. And they told us what's missing in the neighborhood, what challenges they felt were coming. Portland's gentrified, a lot of the nation is gentrified. They were feeling pressures of that, and they were missing some of the services that they wanted. So we got a list of what was missing, what they felt were challenges, and then I asked people if they saved or invested. None of the renters invested, and a handful of them saved, but on a periodic basis. So one fact to add is that 100 million Americans don't have $400 in the bank. And the wealth divide, this is why we did this, the wealth divide, the top 1% own 77% of assets, the bottom 50% own 1%. So that wealth gap is persistent, it's growing, and it's more evident in communities of color and people that don't have upward mobility paths through family wealth, education access, et cetera. The prospects now that we've got a proof of concept, we've been speaking around the country, we've got national advisors, and we want to work in 55 cities in 5 years and touch 1 million families. And right now we've got interest around Oregon. We hope to talk with some people this afternoon in Eugene about doing this. Other places in Oregon are really interested. Outside of that, they're falling nationally into three or four pockets. One are tough urban cities that have wide swaths of poverty. That includes Milwaukee, Wisconsin, St. Louis, Missouri. Other ones have built upon deep long-term planning processes, and they find the opportunity for an investment product for the poor, for lower-income people. By the way, our investment product is open to everybody. We don't income require it. If you want to be involved, you take the class, you pass an understanding test, and you're in. Senator Merkley lives five blocks away, and he's very interested in this, but we've said you have to take the class first. It's one of the requirements. The other pocket, then, as I mentioned, is people building off planning efforts. We've done a feasibility study, and a likely second project's going to be in Colorado Springs. They want to engage youth, and the superintendent of school said, I want middle and high school students to be investors in a building. Now, Colorado Springs is an interesting example because they are excited about an Amazon distribution center coming in at their municipal airport at $15 an hour jobs. At the same time, the strip malls all around town are in the state of repair that you see nationally. You know, people are buying online and those strip malls are going downhill. So we're trying to converge a strategy to re-tenant the building to meet the needs of youth and the motivation of youth with some other attributes. So those are planning process. That's Fresno, California, Colorado Springs, a couple others. The other is First Nation, Native American populations in the Navajo Nation, and then off reservation in Phoenix, Arizona. There's a group of the wide diaspora of people from various nations in one neighborhood. It's about 125 to 150,000 people. An organization's been there for 48 years, and they want to institute a community investment trust in a property that looks very similar to ours in Portland, a 1962 mid-century strip mall.
Thank you for the thorough answer, and look forward to hearing more about the Community Investment Trust as well as your research, Dr. Rothwell. We will open up the questions for City Club members. We just ask for members who are asking questions to be brief in their opening comments and allow enough time for as many people to ask questions as possible. So I'll turn it over to our first questioner.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. I'm quite involved with local homeless folks. And I see newly crashed people every week, and their assets don't mean anything to them because they lose them. They don't see it coming. They don't. If they have something of value, they don't have the money to put it in storage. If they have a car or a van, they can live in it until it gets towed away with everything that they own, including their ID. So I'm finding people that, you know, come in and they need to start all over again with just simply an ID and something to go on. And these people are in their 50s. The big loss is welfare. Welfare doesn't no longer exists in Oregon. It hardly exists on the federal level, SSI. Here, SSI equals about $800 a month, and rents run about $1,200, $1,500 a month, and it's a crash.
Sandy Erickson, City Club. Well, first let me say thank you for mentioning education as the leading cause of a big part of the problem. There are two ways to get money to invest in assets. One is you go to school, you learn something, and you get a good job. The second is you retain the income you do earn, howsoever you earn it. Now, I see a lot of education devoted toward getting a good job, all good. I see none, practically none, devoted toward retaining income. That particular form of education is consumer education. And that means that you have to teach people how to manage a household, which includes their finances, their housing, their clothing and textiles, their food and nutrition. This is what brings people down, the ignorance of getting scammed by consumers' schemes. So my question is there anything at all in your agenda that emphasizes and explores the amount of work that needs to be done in retaining income?
Sven at Community Investment Trust, thank you for that question. Just like John mentioned earlier, the moving from owing to owning class, that's a prerequisite for every person in our model to become an investor. It's focused completely around that changing of mindset from consuming to actually setting aside assets and thinking about that decision. So it's an 8-hour course altogether, but more than half of it goes around that mindset change and homework. The big piece in there that we're looking at is wants versus needs and kind of understanding all those options and figuring out what are your goals that you want to set up for yourself, for your family, how you're going to achieve those, and then starting to plan for that. And when you're getting off track, figuring out ways to get back on track. So that's a big, big part of that education piece that we want to put in around the Community Investment Trust with every investor, that they have to go through that. And then lastly, what we're very excited about is that at the end of the class, we don't just tell you, now go off into the world and succeed. Now that you have all the education about how to stay on budget, we now give you an opportunity to actually start putting that into practice and be that, you know, figure it out in your budget. Is it going to be $10 a month that I'm going to be putting aside, or is it going to be $25? But at least it gives you a step immediately when you're graduating from the class to actually take advantage of something achievable, reasonable, and affordable.
David Rothwell, Oregon State University. So I believe it's Sandy's question. You know, you brought up a good point that comes up in the topic of asset poverty and this idea of individual responsibility and how people can learn how to manage their finances better. This is part of it. However, there's a lot to this answer. The first is that there's not good evidence that changing people's behavior is going to be very effective. The typical financial literacy and financial education programs don't show very good long-term effects unless there's opportunity and access. So, you know, this really calls into example policy and the role that policy can play in broadening access and opportunity for people. Just one example is if you think about how most people, many people in this room and many of the listeners, how most people build wealth is through their employer-sponsored retirement programs. For a lot of people in the growing economy of, as I mentioned, low wage and unstable jobs, a lot of people don't have access they don't have access to mechanisms to build wealth, and without that access, there's not real incentives to do so. So I think, you know, there is an individual component, there is a need to teach people basic money management and planning, but I think our investments and our time would be much more effectively spent talking about policies and interventions farther upstream.
Ruth Tamler. Maybe they need more home ec classes again. I used to be a home ec teacher. They got rid of all of us. But anyway, I'm reading a book now, and the difference of assets that are being bought up by foreign people from foreign countries. I know in California, you have a large Asian purchasing power now. A large percent of homes are being bought up by people from China. And I'm reading a book called World Blass, BLASS. And they show the foundation of the difference in schools and education between our country now and Asia. Completely different. Students really apply themselves, and they're expected to. Here we're having fun, all sorts of things happening in schools, but education doesn't seem to be uppermost. And I was wondering if that's connected to all this asset buying by China.
You know, the flow of capital, John Haynes with Mercy Corps, Community Investment Trust. I think the flow of capital globally is certainly a dynamic force that's changed in the last decade, two decades, that's difficult to track in a lot of cases. I can only refer to one circumstance that's been probably as pronounced as anywhere in the world with an acceleration of real estate value, and that's in British Columbia. There's a professor at UBC that initiated a policy group out of the university called Code Red, and they're specifically trying to target youth because none of the youth can afford to buy a home. He's done studies around the country in Canada that show how many labor years for a couple buying a home would it take to purchase a home. And, you know, before the influx of new immigrants, and he wasn't blaming the immigration from Hong Kong at that time, but it's been, had a pronounced effect. It's made the community richer in a lot of ways. This is Vancouver, BC. But I'm gonna cite this, it may be slightly off, but a couple could work and save for a down payment for a home in between 4 and 5 years in the mid 80s. And today they'd need to work and save for 27 years to be able to make a down payment. So that really indicates that we need other asset classes for people to invest in, and the traditional path of home ownership is unattainable. Other studies have shown that you know, the American dream is eclipsed in a lot of places, but for certain communities that have naturally occurring affordable housing. And there, very often you need to make loans with home improvement attached to it so that families, St. Louis is a really good example, so is Milwaukee, where affordable housing is there. They just need new mechanisms for families to be able to purchase. These are homes that are under 100,000 that just need some home improvement and are, but there's external forces, private equity firms that are buying up hundreds and thousands of homes in those kind of neighborhoods because they see a built value that is gonna pop at some point.
Yeah, I'm Jack Dresser. I guess my question is mainly directed to David. It seems to me there's a pretty intuitively sensible solution to this, some of the income, the asset disparity. Has a solution been considered to add a surcharge, a property tax surcharge on a sliding scale to all properties over $1 million, and use those funds for a housing first program to basically not only eliminate housing homelessness, but to give ownership to those new owners, which is what the Housing First system is.
David Rothwell with Oregon State. I don't have a lot to say on that. That's certainly taxes and redistribution need to be part of the story. There are certain, wealth taxes, for example, are being raised in some of the current presidential campaigns and so on. So I think it is a revenue generating side, a revenue generating question for governments. And, I'm not best positioned on how to do that.
Thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. My name is Susan Connolly. I'm a member since 2008. And I'd like to ask David in particular. I'm a frugal person, always have been. And I've done well as a frugal person. I read that the homes they're building today are 3 times as big as the ones they built 25 years ago. Those houses have to be filled with stuff. And we seem to all be overrun with stuff. So my question is, how much of our super consumerism contributes to the lack of asset building? And I'm not talking about desperately poor people. I'm talking about people that have a little bit. Thank you.
Hi again, David Rothwell, Oregon State University. A cultural explanation, a cultural and market explanation for consumerism and spending, probably factors in here, but I think, to be honest, I haven't seen anyone talk about that, and I'm not sure how we would really quantify that or measure it. I mean, anecdotally, I see the same things you're talking about, but the only thing that comes to mind is a potentially regulatory role that the government could play, but I'm not sure that would be popular across the country. And I'm sure the other, do you guys have comments on that? I'm sure you might.
No. Okay. Yeah, curbing American consumerism, good luck.
John DeLow, City Club member. There seem to be a lot of elements that are a problem with this situation. Can any of you think of, say, one thing that would ameliorate the situation we have now?
John Haynes with the Community Investment Trust. There's a number of policy efforts that are out there. I'll just mention one. David mentioned it before, but universal basic income and then redistribution. In terms of universal basic income, there's been some efforts in other countries that have done well. Obviously, you all know about the state of Alaska that distributes part of their natural resource wealth to the people, and that seems to have worked. The problem, of course, is that Mississippi and other states, you know, buffer states like Wyoming, don't have that sort of natural resource wealth to redistribute. So how you redistribute it is a challenge. One thing that came out of actually Milton Friedman during Nixon's administration, which is a reflection, is the Earned Income Tax Credit. He referred to it at the time as a negative income tax. So mechanisms like that change tax policy are probably more achievable than a lot of bigger changes.
David Rothwell, Oregon State. I spend a lot of time thinking about what the government can do and what kind of policies could be in place. I think the colleagues from Mercy Corps are a really great example of the private sector. But in the public sector, something that Oregon has become known for nationwide is the Oregon Saves program. I had it on my slides. I'm not an authority to talk about it. There are people at the University of Oregon that are. But the idea is that employers are required for certain size firms to provide, or the state is providing retirement plans for a wide class of employees, and I think they've been graduating it from small to medium and then eventually all businesses. So that group of people that I talked about who don't have access to a retirement plan, the state of Oregon is stepping in to fill that gap. And so, you know, I know there's going to be research coming out, but I'm optimistic this will, at least in the retirement long-term planning dimensions of assets and wealth, you know, I'm optimistic this will reduce asset poverty.
My name's Ellen Rifkin. I'm with Eugene Chapter of Showing Up for Racial Justice. We're a member of City Club. And I'd like to thank John Haynes for pointing out the disproportionate effect on communities of color, and particularly Dr. Rothwell talking about the importance of looking at structural causes and not just individual behavior. And along those lines, I'm curious whether researchers are incorporating the specific role of racism in assessing causes of asset poverty, not only in terms of home ownership, which is a traditional stream where people get asset wealth. Just to give a local example, I only found out very recently that in Eugene, if you were a real estate broker, you could lose your license for many decades if you served clients of color. But I'm more interested with respect to the charts that showed the identification of education as a primary determinant of the difference between our country and other countries. And I've just been reading this book by Professor Carol Anderson. She has this really fascinating theory that the collapse of competence and excellence in U.S. education can partially be traced to inequality and racism. And she talks specifically about during the Sputnik era, when we all got freaked out about how advanced the Russians were ahead of us. And right at that time was when Congress, I'll try to make this fast, I'm sorry, was when Congress was, they were debating about equality in the universities, and Brown v. Board had happened. And she shows how in the law, our country at a national legal level made a decision to prioritize keeping Jim Crow policies over the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that we were giving to universities to meet the Sputnik threat without insisting that they keep their, without insisting that they bring in racial equality. And then thinking about the condition of our schools today, okay, sorry. So I'm curious, are people looking into that, the impact of racism on asset poverty?
Thank you.
Okay, David Rothwell, Oregon State. Racism is really difficult to measure, quantify, and understand, but certainly there's excellent work on racial wealth gaps. That we have a lot of good information on that, and I think your point is well taken that to understand the current inequalities we have today, we have to take a historical perspective. Just the most common example in the banking, lending, real estate space is redlining, which many of you may be familiar with, where communities of color were excluded systematically from gaining access to wealth. And you know, there's a long history of racism and exclusion in the country. Yep.
Stay right there. Bob Cassidy, City Club member. My question will be about education in the generations going on. If you have low income in one generation, the asset that you have of education going down to the next generation or the third generation would be more difficult. If it's continued low income, continued minimum wage going through the generations, you don't have an asset to pass on to your kids. Do you study that kind of thing?
David Rothwell, Oregon State University. I don't study intergenerational transmission of inequality, but other people do. I think the most important takeaway is that wealth transmission, wealth inequality is much higher than income inequality. So the income of fathers and the income of their children is not that correlated, but wealth is much higher.
Thanks all of our City Club members for their wonderful questions. There's a lot to digest with this conversation, and I think this is a way forward when we look at how we're going to address poverty going forward. And so before we go and thank our today's guest, I'd like to thank our gold sponsors, Guidos Turnside Balthrop PC, Dr. Sandy Ibarra Herring Associates, and Pacific Cascade Federal Credit Union. We also have in-kind sponsorship from KRVM 91.9 Radio, PAC Info, Dot Dotson's Photography, and Network Charter School. And we also a special thank you to KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs Monday nights at 6:30 p.m. And also to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for airing recent City Club programs. Next week, we will have our annual Gifts to the City program, and we've been asking for quite a while now for your input, and we have 10 guests who will give virtual gifts to our city. Jeanette Keim, Jim, Evangelista, sorry about that, Jim, Bethany Howe, Jean Tate, Clay Beauvais, Eric and Faye DeBoer, and Dave Fananke, Diane Retelak, Heather Siliki, and State Senator James Manning. And I apologize if I mess up anyone's name there. And this program will be hosted by Dan Bryant. Please join us next week. That will be our final City Club program of the year. More details can be found at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, let us thank our speakers, David Rothwell, John Haynes, and Vin Katchev. Thank you all for being here.